just about every patient that we've worked with, they've been told you're just not going to get any better than where you are right now.
Welcome to the Rehab Cast, the official podcast of the American Congress of Rehabilitation Medicine and the Archives of Human Art. I'm your host, Dr. Bill Niehaus from the University of Colorado. Kristen Knuckles, who is an OT and the Chief Clinical Officer at Imago Rehab, which is a company focused on empowering stroke survivors to achieve more thanks to a wearable technology and telehealth service. Kristen has played a key role in translating ideas from an engineering lab into functional tools with a simple question: how can therapy reach patients where they are every single day? We join the conversation as I ask her how she started to build her role in this innovative company.
I'll say in the beginning, I wasn't super sure how I was going to help them because I thought, well, they're the robot engineers. Don't they know how to make robots? No offense to my colleagues,
No.
But just they're kind of saying, well, here are the concepts of how one might make a robot. But I brought the understanding of what do I want it to do? How would I want it to react to the person? What would I, in what sequence of events would these different phases of the robot intervention happen? In what order? Does it matter? Yes, it matters to me what order they go in. There's so many questions, but I felt like I had answers from 15 years of practice working with, mostly patients with stroke over that time. And really understanding literature. I did my post-professional doctorate during that same time. So I was reading every paper there was to read about upper limb motor restoration. And so I felt like I had the answers for that. And so that was a perfect fit for them, looking for the how, the why. They could make a robot move someone, but how and why?
Now that Kristen has described her role in helping in this innovative company, we talked to her about the device itself and how it won the Launchpad Award at the ACRM 2024 conference. Here's her describing it.
All right, so the device that we have created doesn't have a name yet, but maybe we should take crowd comments about what the name should be. So we have a wearable soft robotic glove. It is a fabric-based portion that goes on the hand. It's designed with and by stroke survivors who were participating in our research at Harvard so that they can don it themselves. That's a question we get all the time. Does a caregiver have to be there to put it on? No, it was designed for people who can't use one of their hands well to be able to put it on at home, usually in about 5 minutes. So it takes a little bit of time, but not a lot. So it's a fabric portion that goes around the hand, goes on each finger. It's very stretchy. And then inside the glove, there are bladders or balloons that we inflate with compressed air. So the air travels through tubes and it originates from a control box. Right now it's about the size of a shoebox. Be great if it was a little smaller. So we're working towards that. But it has some vents and it compresses air and pushes that to the glove. And then there's also a control system that incorporates sensors and the electromechanical controllers so that you can move your hand and something happens. So it either plays a game or you can grasp and release real objects or you can do strength and range of motion assessments using the program that we created. So this device is pneumatic. It has air chambers that inflate. So that's how it moves, is that we pressurize air and send it through the tubes. And that allows the fabric to bend and stretch in different ways. And so the properties of the fabric being stiffer or looser allows the air to push in different directions. And so there's bladders that we fill if we want the fingers to straighten, or bladders that we fill if we want them to bend the fingers at the right time. And then there's sensors that are being able to pick up what movement the person is generating.
Very interesting.
So that's the wearable component. And then there's a control system. So that's, a small processor that's inside right now a box about the size of a shoebox. So that sits on the table. And then there's an interface that allows the person to engage with the program. So turn it on, turn up the sound, turn down the sound, change the color of the skin. We have all ranges of skin tones and blue if you just want to be a little jazzy for the day. And then, we can change which side of the body, if it's right side or left side. We can make the games more difficult, less difficult. So kind of customizing with an interface.
You're inevitably there's things that are easier than you ever thought they would be, and then things that you thought would be easy but are way harder. And I'm always curious to hear, in your experience, what were those moments for you as you put this device together with your colleagues in the lab?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the thing that's been the hardest that I maybe didn't plan on being really hard was using balloons to move people around. One of my colleagues at one point created this cartoon figure of the Pillsbury Doughboy with balloons strapped to him because, you know, humans are squishy. And this device is a glove, but there's also a device that's more of a robotic shirt. So okay. You have the shirt on and then balloons inflate under the arms. And just imagine, you know, strapping balloons onto the Pillsbury Doughboy and trying to get the balloons to lift in the right place. Yeah, well, right. You know, just kind of like moving all around, you know, on a squishy structure. So that's complicated.
Makes sense.
And balloons pop.
Yes.
So that's been a challenge. Yeah, it's that we want to do this pneumatic. It's soft. It's comfortable. We're talking about hands that maybe have been clenched for 10 years.
Mm-hmm. And hypersensitive and have all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. So a balloon is a great mechanism to move that structure around, you know, as long as it doesn't pop.
In thinking about this, I'm also curious, from you getting involved in the lab and working with the like very early days to now, what is that timeline like? And just to help people understand, like, how much of an endeavor has this been for you?
I was doing my post-professional doctorate during that time, and I wrote a thesis about using telehealth to support adults with stroke to do rehab from home so we can cut out this, you know, nonsense of having people travel back and forth to get the goods, to learn what to do. Why can't they do those things from home? That's where we want them to do those things anyway, right? So that was pre-COVID, and we were experimenting with doing a telehealth model in 2018. We were, you know, calling these patients up, these research participants, calling them up, teaching them about Zoom. I remember one gentleman who was an angel, and it took him 30 minutes to turn his camera to face the other direction on his tablet. 30 minutes.
Oh, geez.
But that's what we were doing. We were just figuring out what are the hangups. What is so hard, you know, because it was new. And then COVID happened and opened up the billing codes. And so then we launched the business. But we had the idea. We knew the literature says it's possible. Dose matched programs, telehealth or in person, you get the same result. You do not need to be in person. There are certain aspects of therapy that therapists just believe have to be in person, but we find that, you know, you can make incredible, clinically significant gains without touching patients.
Yeah, especially with a device like yours that helps get the therapist in the room, even though they're not.
Yep, helps to be the hands. And there's some exciting work with sensors and things like that, too, where we can, you know, see the patient move. You can help them to know where to move. Again, it's what do you want them to do? Do they have a target to reach for? Do they have feedback that they reached the target? Did they reach it by leaning or by keeping their body still and reaching with a limb? You know, what was it that happened? So there's therapy has such a nuance in order to get the result that you want.
Yeah, and thinking of your device as it exists right now, or maybe it's a thing you're planning on in the future, for that program, is there feedback from the device out? Like if a therapist were to incorporate something like this, would they be able to know what the patient is doing in real time? Or like, how does that interface work? Like, it's great that it does all the things that it does. And it's really, really amazing that it does already all the things that it can do. But are there sensors out as to how well that patient is performing or how much force the machine did versus they did, or what does that look like?
Yes, you have to know all those things to know whether what you're doing is working or not. Mm-hmm. Probably if you ask any therapist, the question they ask their patients the most is, how's it going with your home program? Right?
Right.
And every patient says, oh, I'm doing just fine. Or some of them might say, what is in my home program? You know,
right.
That was my frustration as a clinician of, you know, about 10 years working largely with patients with stroke and have them either saying, oh, it's going fine. And then their wife is behind them going, he's never done it. He's never done it one time, you know? Right. So there's that experience, which is a lot of what I experienced. And then there's the other experience where they go, I don't even know what's in my home program. You know, it's, right. It just doesn't, we just don't translate it well enough in the neuro population. So helping people to know what to do and then getting feedback about whether they did it or not, mm-hmm. not just did they do it, but how, you know, what did they think about it? Was it too hard? Was it too easy? Did they see mm-hmm. the benefit? Is it worthless? You know, you're not going to do a home program if it's not worthwhile, if you don't mm-hmm. believe there's value.
Or you don't see the progress.
Totally. So those things are necessary for getting the engagement. And it you know, it really starts with what are you asking them to do? If you're asking them to do a smattering of exercises, why would they do it? Why would they, what is the value? You know, you really have to know what they're missing, why they're missing it, and then fit in these correct ingredients that, you know, you believe is going to actually make a difference. Not just that you believe, but that you have evidence for.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, that doesn't exist for stroke. I think it exists more in the ortho world where you have this injury and these are the known muscles involved and you need to make them stronger. Great. Brains don't work like that. That's
right.
That's not how we help people with stroke to function better. There's a psychology about it. There's a, you know, a partnership and a relationship and a understanding motivation and understanding, you know, lifestyle. There's so much more. It's so complicated. That, you know, we have to design tools that fit that need. And so that's what we're trying to do. The robot glove is one of the tools, that we, you know, see a need. People need to move their hand and they can't do it. So we need a tool that can comfortably and reliably move a hand, but not all the way. We want them to have to, you know, initiate that movement.
Your device right now, does it provide any of that feedback to the person doing the movements on how well they're doing or how tight that grip got or degrees they moved?
Yep. Yeah, it does all that. We have patents on the assessments, so we can generate strength and range of motion assessments using the glove. And then we track it over time for them so they can see progress. They can see what the difference is. And then the therapist also has access to that information.
And they can see.
You know, we'll say our device is pre-FDA. It's not on the market yet, so you mm-hmm. can't buy it yet.
Okay, yet.
But we are working hard to get it to market and also to, you know, make the changes that we need to really bring the best tool that we're really excited about.
Makes sense. I'm sure it also has like hour or minutes of use or seconds of use or what programs they're using and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
That's
lots
awesome.
Of information. And that, you know, that's just this idea of how many minutes. This was part of what I studied for my OT doctorate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I really wanted to understand the home program. The home program is basically the point of therapy,
mm-hmm.
right? So I remember I had a sentence in my doctoral thesis that said, what patients do outside of therapy is more important than what they do in therapy.
Right.
And I remember some of my peer reviewers saying, that's you can't say that. You can say it's as important. And I said, no, it's not. It is the thing that matters. Mm-hmm. If the patient can't recreate what they did in therapy without you, you did nothing.
Right.
What was the point? So, but being provocative is necessary if you want to change and build something. If you are comfortable, if you're not comfortable with that, then you're not going to build something new.
Right. And even it's even probably an extension further than that. And it's not that they're necessarily even doing the exercise, but it's helping them do that thing they couldn't last week or last month. So it's the grabbing the coffee cup, or it's unbuttoning the shirt, or, you know, chopping up their food. Like that living life part is that ultimate goal.
Right. Yeah. Exercise is not our goal. And that's, you know, especially for the upper limb, exercise is not the mechanism either. It's not about exercises. Again, orthopedic, sure, like that. You have a shoulder. I've had shoulder injuries before. I did exercises. I got stronger. I'm better now. But in the neurologic world, it's really not about rote exercises. It's about task engagement. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, there's just not really good tools built for that. So we are trying to build those tools that really help people get to the end result, which is being able to use their body functionally again.
What other things would you like everyone listening to this podcast to know about the device?
I want other people that are listening to this podcast to be interested and believe that they could also help to design rehab tools. So ours is one tool. There's lots of tools out there. And it's my firm belief that therapists need to be involved in the creation of tools and not wait for them to come to the market.
Makes sense.
Yeah. I think that I was shy about that in the beginning because I assumed that the people who design the devices know all the things they need to know about it. But I really don't think that's true. Really needs to be a big team approach that involves people on the mechanical side all the way to, you know, industrial design to, we had apparel designers, you know, so we had this really robust, interesting, differentiated team to make sure that all the components are designed the correct way. And that includes therapy input.
Kristen Knuckles has reminded us of how the right tools designed with real-world therapy in mind can transform lives, making recovery possible for stroke survivors no matter where they are. From wearable robotics to telehealth innovation, her work underscores the power of persistence and creativity. After this brief break, we will shift gears and explore a different side of neurorehabilitation, precision spasticity management. Dr. Alberto Scanassi will take us through his groundbreaking longitudinal study on botulinum toxin, revealing how this treatment is opening new doors in functional recovery for patients with spasticity. Stick around. This is a conversation you really don't want to miss.
Join us at the ACRM 102nd Annual Fall Conference and Expo from the 25th to the 30th of October, 2025 at the Hilton, Chicago. Experience the latest in rehabilitation research and innovations. Don't miss the free ACRM Rehab Expo open to the public on the 28th and 29th of October, showcasing cutting-edge rehabilitation technology, products, and services. Network with industry leaders and discover new solutions to enhance patient care. Go to acrm.org/expo.
That's what we're looking for. How do we improve function in us? I always tell my mom that when she was alive, she would ask me, what do you do? And I said, I'm a problem fixer.
Welcome back. As promised, we're diving into the fascinating world of spasticity management with Dr. Alberto Scanassi. He is the chair of physical medicine and rehabilitation at Jefferson Einstein Medical Center. He also was one of the key players who
did really the pivotal trials, both for botulinum toxin type A Botox and botulinum type A Dysport for the lower limb.
After talking some, we dive into how he shares his perception of patients' description of their spasticity.
Patients usually will perceive spasticity as stiffness. That's usually the first term that they use. It feels that my arm or my leg is stiff. Two, they feel a lack of control, which may or may not be related to the spasticity. And they also feel that there is difficulty in generating a movement. And that's usually their definition. I'm using their terms. Spasticity per se is not necessarily something that we have to treat, mm-hmm. but it's functional implications of spasticity. And that to me is really, you know, I always consider that managing spasticity has five very critical elements. Number one is you need to figure out what the problem is, and not what you perceive as the problem, but what the patient perceives as the problem. Two, once you have that, what are the elements that compose that problem? You know, if the patient tells you, I have a foot that doesn't stand flat on the ground when I walk, you could say, oh, okay, that's an equinus or an equinovarus deformity. Mm-hmm. What are the implications of that during walking? What are the muscles that may be producing that? And then taking it the next step would be, how do I determine that I can treat those muscles? How do I get my needle with the appropriate dose of medication to those muscles? And finally, how do I localize those muscles and follow that with rehabilitation?
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
When you put all of that together, the easiest part of all of that is putting the needle in the muscle.
Mm-hmm.
It's all of the other components that really will make you very successful at being a good clinician, because you could tell the patients the expectation is we're going to achieve this. And so now you have goal attainment. You can say, did I achieve what we proposed we were going to achieve? Many years ago, we did a very interesting study that was very simple and generated a small publication. But I really felt very proud of that publication. That was that we took five centers that were considered centers of excellence in the management of rehabilitation. And I asked them to have a piece of paper in which they would sign and the patient will co-sign that they have understood what the goals of treatment were.
Mm-hmm.
And so it opened the discussion. You as a clinician sat with a patient. You said, these are the goals of treatment. Do you agree? And the patient would say, yes, I agree. All clear. Mm-hmm. Then the doctor would do whatever they needed to do. Then a second person or a third person in this case would come in and ask the patient to repeat what the goals of treatment were.
Right.
50% of the time, the patients had different goals than what had been stated by the clinician.
Makes sense.
Well, it makes no sense to me.
Well, it makes sense that it happens, but it's unfortunate, right?
Yeah. So we need to be much more precise on how we speak. We need to be able to communicate better with patients. And of course, if you think about outcomes, if the patient really understands what you're trying to do and you both agree to what you are doing, then they're going to come back and they said, doc, you hit it in the head. It was mm-hmm. perfect.
Right. And we're kind of shifting a little bit, but I want to get your take on this. So the way I kind of approach this with patients where I'm considering managing their tone, spasticity, or their stiffness is really making sure they understand to a degree what physiologically is happening. When that upper motor neuron oversight of that reflex arc is impaired, and now sensory information is triggering muscle contraction, which can get stuck in that feed-forward loop, all the different areas that we could target ways to help them with their goals. And making sure they know that, you know, this medication is directed here, this medication is directed here, and botulinum toxin injections being just one of those tools to help figure that all out has really opened the door to have better conversations with patients about how to address the needs that they're talking about. And I really like how your paper went about that and making sure it was goal-directed. Pushes me towards even a further step of making sure not just that they understand it, but are we hitting those marks with them?
Yeah, you presented a very nice way, and that is that it's really all about trying to construct a better toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to have the right elements in your toolbox, you need to know what the job is.
Mm-hmm.
And so that brings you back to the idea of, yeah, botulinum toxin is one more element of treatment. It has some advantages. For example, it has very focal effect. It only affects, if done correctly, if applied correctly, the muscle that you want. If you dose it appropriately, it won't over-weaken the muscle. So you have all of these little elements that go into that toolbox. But if you're just, you know, I always joke that when I initially started seeing other clinicians treat patients, they would say the easiest limb to treat was the upper limb. And I kept saying, why? And their view was, all I need to do is if you have an elbow that it's in flexion, and I relax your elbow flexors, I'll make your arm straight. Mm-hmm. And that meant you really didn't need to understand much function, because it was just from being flexed to being extended. You didn't need to really understand functional anatomy. What are your major elbow flexors versus your elbow extensors? And you didn't need to understand issues of, for example, pronation, supination of your arm and the effects that your elbow flexors have on that. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, if you are injecting for the first time and the objective is to have an arm that was flexed and now have an arm that it's limp, pretty easy to do. Mm-hmm. But if you then turn it around and say to the patient, how do you use that arm? And the patient says, oh, it's perfect. I can put my jacket on my arm, or I can hang my pocketbook in my arm. It'd be nicer if it was not as tight. Ah, so now you can start thinking about, okay, what muscles are contributing to that attitude, to that posture? You know, years back, Nat Mayer and I wrote really the very first paper that created what I consider was a monster. Mm-hmm. I consider that because we decided that it was too complex to see a patient and see all of the different presenting limb deformities, mm-hmm. and not know what to do or where to start. So we decided that we were going to outline all of the deformities that we had seen over the years. And we could, with dynamic EMG, look at which muscles could be the contributing muscles. Mm-hmm. And created a list of, here is the deformity, here are the potential muscles. Pharmaceutical industry looked at that and said, oh, this is a great way to create a recipe book. Mm-hmm. You have a flexed elbow. Here are the muscles you should be injecting, which was never the intent. And so that's why I said that it created a monster, because they tried to convert it into a cookbook approach. Mm-hmm. And that was never the intent. It was really a way to get you to think about what are the possible muscles. You don't need to always inject all the muscles. You may need to think about what is the start position, end position, and look at the biomechanical approach of, or, you know, the functional anatomy of that. And that really was the take. I still cringe when I see these charts that show the different deformities with the muscles, and they say you inject all these muscles with this dosing and you'll solve the problem. Not quite right, but it's the way it goes.
So trying to bring this back into the study you did with all the partners that you pulled this into, I think it'd be helpful to kind of think about, talk to me about the population of people in all the different parts of the world that helped put this together. And what was that group like?
So let me start just a little bit before that. Okay. Maybe just how did we conceptualize this study?
Absolutely.
I think that that's important because this is a longitudinal study. You're very right. The title reflects that. We wanted to capture a large number of individuals, a large number of patients, and we needed to capture a large number of injectors, individuals who treat these patients, because there are subtle differences in the way each one of us does what we do. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to open up the possibilities for clinicians to do what they do without us influencing them. So we didn't say you have to inject this dose or that dose. That was an important point of this. It was really to learn how did they utilize their clinical knowledge and how they applied it to the patients. We did create some guidelines in regards to patient inclusion. You know, we wanted to be sure that these were patients that had hemiparetic problems. You know, we didn't want to have patients who were diplegic or had, involvement in both lower limbs or both upper limbs. We did exclude patients with cerebral palsy because we know they have a different presentation for, you know, growth and development and other issues that go with that line of care. And we didn't want to have patients who had variable presentations. So patients with MS who may have a progressive disorder, we eliminated all of that. So we focus around patients with stroke and patients with traumatic brain injury, which had really a hemiparetic presentation. Mm-hmm. By reasons of logistics, we decided to take adult patients, so anyone who was older than 21 years. For some countries, it was 18. For other countries, mm-hmm. we brought really multiple sites because we needed to collect a large number of patients' data in order to really see if this made sense. So we did some statistical analysis, and we came up with a large number of individuals for this study that were needed. And we needed to see them over time. So what we did is we decided if you had one injection and you never came back, we took that data, but we took that with a grain of salt, and we said, this is one injection. And then we said multiple injections, and some patients came back two times, some patients came three times, some patients came five times. We had some patients that came back six times, mm-hmm. but it ended up being too few patients. And so, again, we did not give so much importance to that grouping. The collaborators were really, you know, individuals who we knew had good reputation as a site of care for neurological mm-hmm. care. Individuals who were willing to collaborate and cooperate in a study, individuals who were able to get, you know, IRB approval and mm-hmm. be serious about what research meant, be able to convert their paper data into an electronic format. So we needed to deposit that data into a combined format. Those were really the major parameters. And then the other parameter that we asked for is, please do use a means of muscle localization and tell us what means that was. You could use electrical stimulation, you could use electromyography, or you could use ultrasound. Mm-hmm. Some places use multiple.
Right.
More than one. And that was acceptable. There were a few sites, again, because this was not regulated in a structured manner that you must do this, that, or the other, that did not use any method of localization. Mm. And that was interesting because that, in another paper, we will showcase that there are differences when you do or you don't. Mm-hmm. The other question that you may have in mind is, why did we pick the lower limb? And that is because there is a functional correlate, walking. And so that was, you know, in the upper limb, you may say, is the arm being used as an assist? Is the arm being used as a tool? Is the arm being used? So it gets more complex. But walking is pretty straightforward. You know, you either walk or not walk. If you walk, how fast do you walk? Did we make a difference and you walk better now?
Right.
So that's why we use the lower limb. Also a little biased because, you know, I work in a gait laboratory. I look at people walk and I think that you cannot get anywhere unless you know how to walk at least a few steps.
Right.
That was the reason.
Makes sense. When you think about, I want to make sure you also highlight, like, this wasn't just in the US, right? This was several different sites, multinational.
It is an international study. We brought patients from a variety of countries in the U.S., in Europe, and Asia. So we brought patients from all of these places. We did look for countries that had similar regulatory limitations on how the toxin is used. So we didn't want to bring a country that may have a much higher dose of application. You know, there may be countries where it's more liberal. So we kind of constrained to those countries to be sure that we were able to keep more or less the same dosing across, so that even though you may be using it slightly different, the total dosing didn't exceed limits that we would in the US or in some of the countries in Europe would exceed.
Makes sense. And then in terms of, you kind of highlighted this, but with ambulation being the goal, you picked a particular outcome measure that I think is worth talking about a little bit as well. Gas leg T,
you're correct. So that's the name of the test. This is a test that was developed by British collaborators. The goal attainment scale is really a tool that was developed initially for the upper limb. And so the gas gate was, the gas leg looks specific at things that are related to mobility in the walking environment, you know, transfers, walking, steps. And that was, I think, a very nice tool to bring about because it is a tool that has been used across Europe quite a bit. We're not as good at using those kinds of tools in the US. They add time and complexity to what we do, and our electronic medical records are really not set to capture that data. So it requires additional work. But I think that it was important because it gave us a parameter that we could use across, and everybody had to follow. So since everybody's goal was the same, walking, it was easy to deploy that. We did have to train the Americans more than the Europeans, and definitely the Asians more than all of us on how to use those tools. But it's a simple tool. It works well. And you can look it up at, you know, one of the co-authors of the paper who really developed the tool and got it to you know, be clinically useful, because in the beginning it was not so easy to use. He really worked at it until he got it to do what it is now. I will tell you, I use it frequently in my clinical practice. I don't say that I use it all the time, but I use it frequently. And, you know, it's good to be honest. He uses it all the time. And we've compared notes, and I think it it works well. And it takes literally a couple more minutes. That's all it takes.
Walk me through what it actually consists of. Is it for the people listening? Is this a like a patient reported thing? Is this something you set up with questions? What does it look like in practice?
It's a combination. You observe some and you ask questions of the patient. So it has both. So what the leg A measure, you know, the gas leg A measure is really impact on life. And so what we ask are things like, do you have limitations in daily activities? Does it interfere with mobility and balance? Are there difficulties to care for your affected leg? Do you have restrictions in range of motion? So that's really what we are, limitation in mobility, limitation in the use of your leg, limitation in the ability to care for the leg. And this six parameters really evoke clearly how you're doing. And then to supplement that, we measure walking velocity. And so that really kind of wraps up everything that we need to address the, I'm going to call it the burden of lower limb spasticity in mobility and ambulation.
And then putting this in the context of the study, the study then looked at, were there improvements in these domains for the patients, right? Explain how in the study you used this score following multiple botulinum toxin injections and whether those goals were met or not.
So what we were able to do is score these different metrics. And there were, in addition to the questionnaire, as I said, walking velocity, but things like Do you walk outdoors? Do you walk on even grounds? Do you walk, upstairs? How do you feel when you turn? Those kinds of things. And what we were able to show is that over time, the scoring method is you have no difficulty, you have moderate difficulty, or it's very difficult. And so what we did then is re-measured those periodically, and we saw the shift of the scores over time. And we noticed, and this population was large enough that allows us to do comparative studies, and we could see really an improvement in a magnitude of up to nearly 3 points in this in this scale. And that's pretty significant. That is, it's not only clinically meaningful, but it's significant in its change.
That's great. And that's, I think that's the, that's a sweet spot for research, right? You want it to show that there was a difference, but not more than that. You want it to show that there was a difference that is clinically meaningful for both providers and the patients, to make sure that what we're doing helps them with their lives and improves their function and gets them doing more things.
It's definite that, as rehabilitation physician, as physiatrist, that's what we're looking for. How do we improve function? As I always tell my mom, when she was alive, she would ask me, "What do you do?" And I said, "I'm a problem fixer." You look at a problem and you say, "How can I fix this?" And it may be that you could do that with able botulinum toxin, or you could do that with, on a botulinum toxin, or you may do that with a brace, or you may do that with therapy, or you may do that truly with a combination of all of those things. And that's what we do. It gets you back to the idea of the toolbox and what are the elements, and then what is it you're trying to fix with your toolbox?
Mm-hmm. And making sure it's a collaborative effort and not just a one-size-fits-all algorithm.
Well, rehab is that. It's a team effort. It's, I always call this a team sport. It's really, we work in teams precisely for that, because no one individual knows all or has all the answers. And two, because patients have much more complex presentation than, a simple, "My finger hurts."
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. If you're going to, take this study that showed that there was improvement towards goals, towards function with these serial botulinum toxin injections, how would you translate this to a given provider that may be interested in starting doing these and is starting out thinking about how they would approach patients with spasticity and stiffness? And then another question that we can think about too, how did this impact you, a more experienced clinician, thinking about how to best care for these types of patients?
So the intent is to really, I'll start from the second part of the question, and is how does this study really impacted my clinical practice? And that is that, number one, the objectives of treatment are not fixed. So it is not the patient comes in the door, "Hi, Mr. Smith, I remember that we injected you here, there, and there. We're going to do the same today." It really should be, how did we do? Did we achieve the goal? Do we need to move the goal up? Do we need to adjust it down? Do we need to completely change the goal?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one. That reassessment is, in my view, critical and something that I would encourage everybody to do. It does take 2 more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know pressure, the pressures for time, but having those 2 minutes can make a huge difference on what the patient perceives you're doing and the outcomes of that intervention.
Absolutely.
That gets linked to the next step, which is, how can you get these patients to keep coming back, injection after injection after injection? If you look nationally, the average number of patients coming back for retreatment is about 3 to 4.
Percent? Or what do you mean, 3 to 4?
That said, patients disappear after that.
Oh, gotcha.
You go to a center and they will say, "Oh, the patient came once, twice." And then by the third time, the patient says, it made no difference, or I didn't feel any improvement, or I didn't get what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. But in those centers where you have this approach with goal attainment and you take the time, would you see that patients keep coming back? Mm-hmm. And I have my, you know, my personal database at work that I can tell you, I have patients that I've been treating for more than 20 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, twice a year I have them there. They come up, they tell me I'm ready for my treatment, and they say, I want to continue to do this because it's beneficial. You tell me what the problem is. We work together. So this approach of a collaborative patient-doctor relationship is critical. And we as rehabilitation physicians are very good at doing that. And we should not dismiss the importance of getting it done that way.
Amen. Well said.
The other thing that I can tell you we've seen is that over time, the metrics appear to improve further. And my interpretation of that, and this is not all of my co-authors, but my interpretation is that you start with a patient who's more on the chronic side. They have lots of limitations. As you're treating them and you repeat the treatments, you're making really gains that are being one on top of the next. Mm-hmm. That is very helpful. And you see that over time. And we see it in a resulting further increase in both the objective measures that we had and the subjective measures that we had.
Makes sense. I almost think of it as further optimization, or thinking about it like almost like you're trying to narrow in on that accuracy of hitting your target. The ideal goal is made, and you're going to make moves in different directions to try and more consistently hit that. And ideally, those adjustments get smaller and smaller as you narrow in on that spot, but you're never quite done trying to tune it to that person in that circumstance with those issues.
I think you're very correct. I'll add to that, that remember, we are a biological system and we mm-hmm. change. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a perfect example that relates to spasticity. You measure Tardu or Ashworth in the morning, or you measure Tardu or Ashworth in the afternoon, you may get a slightly different reading. Mm-hmm. If you measure it when it's cold or it's warm, you may get a different reading. So again, we're biological systems and we are constantly adjusting and changing. Our treatment and our approach to treatment should pair with that.
Mm-hmm. Amen. Amen. This is great. The study itself is really good at outlining how you impacted those 300 or so participants and what those goals are. I'm always curious, are there other things that you've been thinking about or think the next steps are to make sure that the listeners to this podcast are aware of?
Well, definitely there are a few other items that are important. And, you know, we'll hopefully report on this in the near future. But we know that experience makes some difference. Mm-hmm. And so we want to look at individuals who were more experienced, more patients, more years of treatment versus individuals who had less experience, if there is a difference there. We had done a prior study which showed some difference, but I think this study is much more structured in the sense of the longitudinal approach. And so it might be interesting to see, did you get better over time as an individual who had less or more experience? Mm-hmm. The other is the impact of using localization. Mm-hmm. We think that that has an impact. If you are using EMG, ultrasound, or electrical stimulation versus nothing, that may make a difference. Mm-hmm. And I think further work to be done is to look at, if you treat the lower limb primarily, but you also treat the upper limb because there were some issues that you needed to address, does that make a difference? A previous study I published some years back showed that you could change, you could impact walking velocity by treating the upper limb alone. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that, you know, we can think about the impact of your arm in the the way you walk. So I think that that's important. You had asked me about the number of centers, and I think it's critical that I mention, you know, we had 47 centers across the world. So Canada, the US, Brazil, we did Germany, Poland, Australia, Russia, France, and Italy. Those were the countries that we recruited from. And then you said 300 and some patients, but really we recruited 438 patients as the number to start. So I think that that's an important component to this. The other quick point that I think is worth mentioning really is my co-authors. I think that I need to credit them because they put a lot of work on this as well. Richard Sorowitz, Steve Ashford, who's the guy who really developed the GAS A measure. And then we had the Jorge Jacinto, who's in Portugal, although his center did not provide patients because there were issues with IRB permits in the Portugal. He was really a key element in thinking of this study along with me. And then we had really support from Christian Haynes and Pascal Maisonov, both who really were great collaborators of us. So that gives you a wide thinking of the group. And I think the last point I will make, which I think it's important, is remember this study was longitudinal, mm-hmm. and this study was observational. So those are two important characteristics.
As we wrap up this episode, it is clear that rehabilitation is being transformed by both innovative technology and precision treatment. Kristen Knuckles showed us how wearable robotics and telehealth are making stroke recovery ever more accessible, empowering patients to engage in therapy anytime and anywhere. Meanwhile, Dr. Alberto Scanassi highlighted the power of botulinum toxin in managing spasticity, not just as a treatment, but as a tool for achieving meaningful functional goals. Together, these conversations remind us that the future of rehab isn't just about new tools or treatments. It's about how we apply them to improve individual lives. Whether through cutting-edge devices or patient-centered spasticity care, rehabilitation continues to push boundaries, giving patients more opportunity to regain function and independence. Thank you so much for joining us today on the ACRM Rehab Cast. I'd love to hear from you. Tell me your thoughts, your feedback, and topics you might be interested in hearing about in future episodes. Message me directly on social media at NHAUSMD. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review this wherever you're listening. It really does help amplify and celebrate the incredible world of rehabilitation. I ask every guest a series of lightning round questions at the end of our conversation. Here are some of the highlights I found really interesting. I'm always curious when I ask guests about some unusual jobs they've had and what you learned from it. Dr. Scanassi had some really good insights when he talked about his time as a welder.
I was a welder, and I spent time welding window frames and frames for beds. What I learned from it is that job of that kind can be really, really dangerous to your eyes. When you're using a welding arc, it's not that you have the sparks that may jump at you, but it's the intensity of the light. I appreciated learning that maybe a little late because I had to deal with the pain of having my eyes really suffer through that once. But after that, I learned how to do it without exposing my eyes to the intense light.
I'm always curious to hear how childhood activities translated into the different roles people take as professionals. Both Alberto and Kristen talk about how they experienced different things in their childhood that really grew into some of the interests they have now as rehab professionals.
I lived in sort of a rural area in a college town in Virginia, and we had woods behind our house, and I would disappear into the woods, and I'd build fairy houses and climb trees and look at deer, and I'd come home eventually.
I used to disassemble my sister's dolls and then put them back together. And the challenge was I had to be sure that I made it work again and that I had no leftover parts.
It's also interesting to hear from Dr. Eskenazi about a moment in his life that really felt like a scene from a movie, and it really helped guide his future path into rehabilitation medicine.
Well, I was involved in a chemical accident. That's how I lost my hand. And I think that felt a lot like a movie, you know, a movie that I wanted to initially end quickly because it was painful. But then, you know, it ended up being I can't say it was a good thing, but it was something that ended up in a positive note. My intent was to be a pediatric surgeon. And I think I'm a much better rehab physician than I would have been a surgeon.
I think it would be good to close with both guests' responses on how they thank people and how they find them helpful. It's something that we should really look for and seek out to do on a regular basis to make sure those around us really know how much we appreciate them and the work that they do.
I try to thank people who are helpful verbally. I try to help them to know that they were helpful. Mm-hmm. A lot of therapists are just sort of, we're nice people mm-hmm. and we're friendly people, but it's really important to make sure that people know. You know, on our team at Imago, we have a number of Slack channels that are open to the whole team, and we have a kudos channel. And so if someone helps you with a project or someone just was a rock star that day, we try to put it in the kudos chat so everyone just gets to see that somebody was awesome today. And, you know, overall, everybody gives a clap emoji or a, you know, something that just makes people feel good.
The idea of always being helpful to people is something that we do every day. And so we see those as small examples, but they are what makes us bigger people, because being kind is important to who we are every day.
Thanks again for listening to this episode. I'm Dr. Bill Niehaus from the University of Colorado. Special thanks to Jenny Ament, who produced this episode. Rehabcast music is by the Mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. And now the mandated promotional material in the style of a TV game show host. And now let's see what's behind door number one. It's the 2025 ACRM Fall Conference and Expo. That's right, you could be whisked away to the Hilton Chicago from October 25th through the 30th. Just imagine 6 days of groundbreaking research, top-tier networking, and hands-on innovation, all set against the backdrop of one of America's most vibrant cities. Make sure you secure your spot at the premier multidisciplinary rehab event of the year. And if you can't make it in person, don't worry. You can follow along at home with the hashtag ACRM2025. This is one event you don't want to miss.